The Fearless Podcast, in a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act.
John Titus, welcome to the Fearless Podcast. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. It's my first time.
Hey, thanks for coming on. I've been following your work, I think, since like 15 or 16, and one of the main reasons I love your work is the way that you explain incredibly complex things for people like me that are more street savvy, but aren't quite as technical. And I just appreciate everything that you do. And, you know, we homeschool our kids and I even use some of your material, you know, like, for example, I'll give you Mommy, Where Does Money Come From? You know what I mean? Yeah. I love your content. And I saw this new docuseries you got going on. You've teamed up with Catherine Austin Fitz in the Solari Report. So it's like this convergence of all these different resources that I really appreciate, like the Corbett Report and like Solari. And I'm like, this is like Wonder Teams activate here. And I thought it was awesome that she's picking up your series and kind of galvanizing it so that it can't be censored by they, them, and those.
Yeah, yeah. So I've done a podcast with her for years, and I pitched the series to her because I knew it was going to be 8 episodes. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I can't predict what YouTube or BitChute or these guys are going to do. I don't want to get, you know, 2, 3, 4 episodes into the series and have them yank the rug on me. That was the first impulse, so to go to Catherine and say, hey, would you just sort of be my safe harbor in any storm that might come. And she said, yeah. And I'm like, well, as long as you're going to do that, could you also sort of be like the library in case people coming behind me see a clip that they haven't seen before, which I know they're going to see clips that no one's ever seen before. And allow people to download clips and allow people to download hearing transcripts and statutes and whatever other materials I'm using. So it's sort of an open-sourced video series.
Yeah, the beauty of what you do is you document everything, you hyperlink it, so it's not like, oh, this is some kind of isolated event. I mean, everything's clearly documented. So maybe as an introduction, we could talk about what is the war for bankocracy.
Yeah, okay, great question. The war for bankocracy is a multi-century push by central bankers for control. But let me take a step back. You know, the U.S. is known for being sort of a harbor for the rule of law. You know, our country, the top authority in our country is the U.S. Constitution. It's not a king, it's not a president, it's not, you know, it's the law. Everybody answers to the law, and everybody is included within the law's protection. That's the idea of the rule of law. And so the problem with banks generally, and central banks in particular, is that the world really, you know, under the rule of law, everybody's the same. You know, one person's the same as the next, but on banking, they're not the same. The world divides into two categories. There's the small little tiny category of 0.1% of people or less that can print money out of thin air and lend it to everybody else. And then the second category is everybody else. So every bit of money you have was borrowed into existence. And you might say, well, you know, I've got money in my bank. I didn't borrow it, which is true. But if you could trace that money back from where you got it, and sort of you got it from Ted, and he got it from Larry, and Larry got it from Susie, that money was borrowed into existence. Trust me. And so that's really the impetus. It's like, well, the banking, commercial banks aren't set up really. There's a fundamental disequilibrium there. But that's really not that huge a problem, because banks don't really issue money. They issue credit. When you go into a bank and you deposit $100 in a bank, you don't own that money anymore. You're an unsecured creditor. Now, you may not know that, but that's the case. You are lending your money to that bank. That's why banks have FDIC insurance. If it was real money, there'd be no need for insurance. But the banks need insurance because it's actually unsecured debt. You're an unsecured creditor of the bank. That's sort of one deal. The problem, though, occurs on the wholesale level. The banks I'm talking about, my bank, your bank, those are all retail banks. And it's a system run on credit. The wholesale level, though, that's the central bank level. Now we're getting into sovereign money, right? And that's a problem when you've got, again, one tiny group of people that can conjure up money into existence and then lend it to everybody else. That's the fundamental problem. And because of that, because the money issues is debt, even at the sovereign level, it shouldn't, but it does. That's just the way the system's been set up. It's set up like that starting really in 1694 with the Bank of England, the creation of the Bank of England. Set that up where the country could have printed its own money, but it doesn't do that. It outsources the print job to a small clack of people and says, hey, why don't you guys print the money? And the banker's like, yeah, we'll print the money. And then the bankers turn around and lend the money to the country. And it's like, well, I don't understand. I mean, why didn't you just issue the money? What, you know, I feel like the guy in Office Space. Like, what would you say you actually do for the country here? You know, you print the money, you put the ink on the paper, and then you lend it out to us at an interest rate? You know, it's crazy. And so because of that system, it's sort of an exponential debt system, the problems it creates tend to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And what you end up with is these central banks are like Pac-Man. And there's like, rah, 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 and they're eating up whole countries, and they're eating up colonies, and they're eating up assets, and they're eating up industries, and they're getting rid of farmers in the U.S., and they're getting rid of engineers, which I was at one time. You know, they outsource that, and it becomes, and then eventually the end game is you're left with a casino, and that's where we are now, sort of the rigged casino phase of our existence. And so I call it the war for bankocracy because it attempts to detail that's the historical sweep of that process.
Yeah, and I guess maybe to in episode two, you kind of lay it out and break it down historically from the founders, like those like Thomas Jefferson that warned about this and put safeguards in place. I think this is kind of the crux of the issue of what makes America and our banking system unique to the rest of the world, relatively speaking, that has already been exclusively hijacked and completely private or censored, or, you know, I forget the Rand Paul quote, but he said that
it was Ron Paul.
Ron Paul. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He said that really what independent means is secrecy.
Yeah. He got that right. We're going to see that. We're going to see that very quote again. That's funny you bring that up.
So we were warned about this, and because we were warned about it, the founders baked into the constitutional cake the checks and balances, which is now somehow so much later. Why they haven't done this sooner, which is largely in part, I think, because of people bringing awareness to the issue and guys like Ron Paul that keep saying, we need to end the Fed, we need to, at a minimum, audit the Fed. I think was your driving force to do this now, because we are at a tipping point where they're really trying to take down the system.
Yeah, I hesitate to read into people's actions to try to infer intent. I'd leave that to others. But there's patterns you could see, like, well, what are you up to? It tends to be no good. But you're exactly right. The series really is, it's a very vigorous defense of the U.S. Constitution. It's very stylish these days to be like, oh, the Constitution, they got this wrong. No, they didn't. Constitution's right. To start with that. Okay? It's still around. It's been around, and there's a reason it's been around, and there's a reason it's set up with the way it is. And you mentioned that the U.S., monetary system is unique due to the Constitution. Let me explain that kind of quickly. In our system, the founders put in Article 1, so there's three major articles 1, 2, and 3, the legislature, the executive branch, and the judiciary. Okay, those are the three branches that hold sovereign power, and then the three articles of the Constitution. The power of money issuance is in Article 1, so it belongs to Congress. Congress has the right to coin money and has the right to issue, to borrow money on the credit of the U.S., which is the same as issuing credit. So the Congress is given those two powers. Now, how does that differ from other countries? Well, in other countries, and I use Europe as my foil to sort of explain, here's the Constitution. The Constitution does it the right way. Europe does it the wrong way. What Europe did is they have a treaty that set up the European Central Banks, and it's the treaty that gives the European Central Bank its monetary power. So now, if you look at where the central bank came from in the two countries, in Europe, the central bank, the ECB, European Central Bank, came from that treaty. You don't like the bank? Well, now you got to change the treaty. That's difficult to change a treaty because there's 19 or 20 countries that signed on to it, and it's a major undertaking to change a treaty. It's not going to happen. Or you can just get out of the treaty, in which case you won't be able to use your money anymore. You have to use your own currency. The U.S. is totally different. The U.S., the monetary power is with the Federal Reserve, but it was a delegated power by Congress. The power always ultimately rests with Congress. So if you look at what the powers the Fed has, it has its powers 100% due to the Federal Reserve Act, an act. It's a statute. It passed in 1913. Had a statute passed. They passed with a majority of the House, a majority of the Senate, and the signature of the president. So what does that tell you? That tells you that if we want to get rid of the Fed, if we don't like the Fed, all you need is a majority of the House, a majority of the Senate, and a signature of the president, and you can repeal the Federal Reserve Act, and you can delete the Fed. And that's due to the Constitution and the way it's set up, because the monetary power ultimately rests with Congress. Congress is the owner. The Fed's the renter. We can kick the tenant out whenever we want. All we need is a majority. And that's a fundamental difference, because the Fed, you also mentioned auditing by Ron Paul. The Fed has to be transparent to Congress. Congress has inherent transparency into the Fed. We learned where all the bailout money went in 2008 due to the transparency provision, which is another way of saying it, due to the Constitution. In Europe, by contrast, the treaty says it's illegal for countries to really interact with the central bank. The central bank is a power, it's a government unto itself, and does whatever it wants. There's no checks and balances over there. There's no transparency over there. They have window display transparency. Yeah, they issue a report here and there. But if push comes to shove and Belgium or Germany wants to find out, hey, what documents are behind that decision, the ECB isn't going to tell them. And the ECB is run by, or has at one time, was run by Christine Lagarde, who's an adjudicator. She's a criminal of record. It's a nightmare over there. So our system, you know, I'm not a fan of the Federal Reserve. Obviously, I've done a lot of videos just really taking it to the Fed. But I am a fan of the U.S. Constitution, and I am a fan of the shackles that the U.S. Constitution puts on the Fed and the control that it gives us, the people, over the Fed. Because when we get angry enough and start calling Congress, they answer. They have to cough up documents and disclose information. And I'm going to show that in episode 4 of my series, big time.
Now, okay, so Congress does have oversight over the Fed. This is a big question that I've had, that I've put out there several times, because the main issue, and you break it down, it's either in the first or second episode, of how when they infused all this liquidity, the Fed, the one that's supposedly responsible for controlling inflation, created inflation by adding an extra $4 trillion, you know, into the liquidity. Can Congress extract, you know, if the Fed's still in place, can Congress extract liquidity?
They could.
They can.
They instruct the Fed. They can do whatever they want with the Fed. The Fed's a creature of Congress. They answer to Congress, not the other way around. They could do that. But as a practical matter, the Fed is very good at expanding its balance sheet. It's easy to expand a balance sheet because it just involves spending money into existence, right? You write the money out as an IOU, and it's counterbalanced by an asset that you purchase with the IOU you just issued. It's crazy. Contracting the balance sheet is a different matter. Contracting the balance, the Fed could contract, in theory, the Fed, Congress, they could contract the balance sheet by selling assets, not buying assets. So in other words, they go to the people holding assets and say, hey, sell us your asset, and then, you know, their accounts would be debited, and that would shrink the money supply. As a practical matter, that's not how the balance sheet shrinks. the way the balance sheet shrinks is all those monetary issues, all the debt in the country, it's got a time stamp on it. So it's 30-year bonds, 10-year bonds, 5-year notes, whatever, two-year pieces of paper. All of those things, over time, they get paid off. And over time, the principal comes down naturally. It's sort of like when you pay off your mortgage. You know, you start out at the beginning of a 30-year mortgage with a $1,000 payment. That principal, yeah, you're just nibbling at that principal. And it's not until the end that the vast majority of your $1,000 check is knocking down principal. And that's how the balance sheet shrinks, is those pieces of paper, like your mortgage, they roll off over time. They don't really sell assets. That's just not how they do it. But to answer your question theoretically, yeah, Congress could do exactly that. Congress has complete monetary authority under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, the right to coin money.
So if there was a movement to delete the Fed, like you said, and Congress took its responsibility back to coin money, and this might not be an easy question to answer, how do we convert from that Fed-run liquidity to sovereign money?
Well, you got two different. First of all, you would have to honor. Let's just start with Federal Reserve notes. You'd have to honor those, even though those are a liability of the Fed. If you read the law, they're actually an obligation of the United States. So it's sort of like a mall. If you've ever been to a big mall, you know, an individual store might issue a gift certificate, or the mall might issue a gift certificate. It's an obligation of the mall, but it's the liability of whatever store that gift certificate shows up at, right? So it's technically kind of complicated like that. But you start with some basics. You got to honor your Federal Reserve notes because they're legal tender. All right, those are issues of the Federal Reserve, but they're legal tender in the U.S. Good for all debts, public and private. You'd honor, you know, obviously the bonds aren't even issued by the Fed. The bonds are issued by the Treasury. You keep honoring those. You could do it. You could sort of freeze things in place now. And like I said, just sort of let things take their course. Let bonds get paid off over time. Let the balance sheet roll off over time. And just have regular money coining going on, you know, with Congress issuing non-debt-based money, because it's the debt that gets you into trouble. It's the interest on the debt. That's what creates the spiral. Money doesn't have, it's people tell you money is debt. That's wrong as a matter of law. That is absolutely a false legal statement. Money is not debt. They are not the same. They are different. You use money to pay debt. So you want a system where money is issued. Like Lincoln issued greenbacks, that was money. And you
probably
go sort of you go
shot.
With sort of a greenback system. The greenback system gets bashed a lot, but if you read it pretty carefully, the first wave of greenbacks that came out were true money, and they retained their value 100%. It was some of the later issued greenbacks where Congress started putting some exceptions into what the greenback could do, like, well, you could use it for this, but you can't use it to pay duties and fees. And it gutted the value of their own notes. It's stupid. But when you're issuing pure money, as long as you monitor, the name of the game when you issue money is you want the amount of money in circulation to be about where the output of the country is, its productive output. But it's got to be real output. Real output doesn't include you and I made a bet for $50. You know, that doesn't really count. That's not real output. If you monitor the output of your country, you know, what your farms are putting out, what your factories are putting out, you know, what services or good services are putting out, and you added them all together, as long as your money supply roughly tracks that, you're fine. You won't have inflation or deflation. It's been done before.
And so another major issue, I think, with all of this, maybe you could break it down, is how does the Federal Reserve function as a tool for consolidating power into the hands of the few? Because you kind of alluded to this, but maybe you could talk about that as far as like who owns these private banks and how who they are is shrouded under all this, you know, corporate privacy. I think that's a very large issue as well.
Yeah. So that's a great point. There's really, when we talk about the Federal Reserve, we talked about it like it's one unitary body, when it really isn't. It's two distinct entities. There's a public entity, kind of the public face of it, with Jerome Powell, been before him, Janet Yellen, and Bernie Bernanke and them. That's the face of the Fed. That's the federal. That's what's called the Board of Governors. Board of Governors has a chairman. There's a bunch of governors. They're appointed by the president. They're confirmed by the Senate. They're paid by the federal government. The Fed Board of Governors maintains its own balance sheet. That's not the real Fed, though. The Board of Governors doesn't issue any money. In fact, the Board of Governors, it doesn't even take deposits. It's another government office, basically. The real Fed are the 12 Federal Reserve banks, the regional Federal Reserve banks, which really you could call them the New York Fed and the 11 dwarfs. The 11 dwarfs are the Federal Reserve banks of, you know, Richmond, Atlanta, Philadelphia, Boston, you know, Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City, and on and on. Those are the regional Fed. In fact, now that I say Philadelphia, that doesn't sound right to me. Anyway, it's neither here nor there. It's 11 regional Federal Reserve banks around the country and the New York Fed. The New York Fed is the one that has the Bloomberg terminals in its office. It can do the buying and selling of securities there and all the rest. But if you look at the Federal Reserve balance sheet, if you go to the Board of Governors website, they report the Fed's balance sheet. But if you read it carefully, if you go to Table 5, what you'll see is all the money part of the Fed, which is on the liability side of the balance sheet. So the liabilities include things like Federal Reserve notes. That's a liability. Like reverse repos, that's a liability. Deposit accounts at the Fed, in other words, bank accounts held at the Fed by banks, that's a liability. Those liabilities are actually, when you look at the sum total, if you looked at the Fed's balance sheet and you said, hey, look, I see there's $7.5 trillion of liabilities on the Fed's balance sheet. If you break it down on the Table 5, what you'll see is that $7.5 trillion is coming from 12 regional Federal Reserve banks that are just added together. Those 12 regional Federal Reserve banks are each privately owned, and they're owned by the banks, the commercial banks in their district. So, for example, the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, its biggest owner in that bank would be Wells Fargo, because Wells Fargo is headquartered in California. Same in New York. The New York Fed is the biggest Fed member. Its two biggest shareholders are J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup. And all the regional Fed banks are like that. But the point is this, is you don't know who owns, you know the banks own the Fed, commercial banks, in proportion to how big they are, basically. But it's a corporate ownership. And corporate ownership doesn't, you can't ever pierce the veil and figure out, well, who owns the corporation? If you go to their proxy statements, their annual, their 10K filings with the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, you know, these companies all issue annual reports. Companies, including banks, issue annual reports. If you read the annual reports, there's a section of the annual report called the proxy statement, which tells you the biggest shareholders of the banks. Okay, so you go to the proxy statement. What does it tell you? It tells you that J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup are both owned by, their biggest shareholders are Vanguard and BlackRock and Berkshire Hathaway, and you get into this onion where it's the same names over and over and over again, and you never have any idea of, like, well, do the Rothschilds have a piece of this? Of course they do. You'll never find out how much. Do the Warburgs have a piece of this? Yeah, they do. All these names that you've seen throughout history, they're there, but they're in the shadows. You never find them. So you don't really know who owns these banks. And that's ultimately sort of the problem, which is there's no transparency in the Fed. Now, I said there's two entities, the private entity and the public entity. You might think, well, the private entity, which wants to remain hidden, it's owned by families, owned by people who wish to remain anonymous. You'd think that would be the anti-transparency wing of the Fed. And you'd be right. It is anti-transparency, the 12 Federal Reserve banks. But the public Board of Governors is also anti-transparency. They tell you they're pro-transparency, but then you ask for a document, and the first thing they tell you is, well, we can't disclose that, or, you know, the sky would start falling, and it would cause systemic disruptions, so we're not going to turn that over. They're very anti-transparency. Why do I bring that up? Because it's strange that the public, if it's really the public face of the Fed, why does it sound so much Why does it sound like it's always advancing the interest of the 12 privately owned Federal Reserve banks to issue money? You follow me?
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. It's public in name only.
Well, it's exactly like if you start drilling down into Wall Street and you go to all these transnational monolithic corporations, and what you'll find is that the top five shareholders of almost any company you can name is BlackRock, Black State Street, Vanguard,
right,
and Blackstone. You know, it's like, and then you get into the fact of, like, if you have these huge monolithic transnational mega corporations basically owning the lion's share of all these corporations, and now basically what you're saying is these exact same four or five massive transnational companies have major stakes in the Fed. If you're controlling these supposed capitalistic structures and you're also simultaneously controlling the money masters and the money source, like, you are really controlling the whole ball of wax.
Right, right. And for a long time in the U.S., there was what's called sort of a, you know, like we had the separation of church and state in the U.S. So it's sort of an informal doctrine. For a long time, there was sort of an informal doctrine in the U.S. It was a separation of banking and commerce. The theory being, you know, the person who issues the money shouldn't be able to both issue the money and then get mixed up and start being able to create factories too, right? I mean, because how could you, you know, if you're a business owner, a legit Main Street business owner, how are you going to compete with a guy who doesn't have any cost of capital? He just issued money. He just issued money and buys businesses. Well, those are supposed to be separate. And for a while, that was even as recently as 2015 or so, that was honored. It was Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley got in trouble because they were going around violating the separation of banking and commerce by buying up aluminum factories and cornering the aluminum market. And it was a lawsuit by Coke, of all people, against Goldman Sachs saying, you guys are killing us. This is unfair competition. And it got Goldman and it got Morgan Stanley out of that racket. But that's the notion. You're exactly right. You're also right that because of BlackRock, it's not a bank, it's a financial corporation. And because things are hidden, it's really harder to enforce that notion that you can't have the people issuing money controlling commerce. And it's gotten worse and worse and worse and worse with less and less regulation and with less and less law enforcement. Regulation is sort of a two-edged sword, but law enforcement, you know, that went by the wayside under Obama. You know, it was crazy. Remember, banks were, HSBC, it just admitted that it perpetrated money laundering for drug dealers and terrorists on a massive scale. And the Justice Department not only didn't prosecute, they didn't investigate. It's like, well, the Justice Department's like, well, we find them. It's like, are you kidding me?
Well, yeah, you can print the money to pay your fines. So what difference does it make? Oh, what do you want me to pay, $1 trillion? Oh, what, you want me to pay $100 trillion? Yeah, sure, no problem.
Or like HSBC, there's another way to pay your fine, and that's simply to commit more crimes.
Right. Real drug dealers, man, that's like,
yeah.
This is like real mafia. Like,
yeah, that was a shocking thing. And that HSBC, the same week the HSBC case gets decided in favor of, well, we can't prosecute HSBC because that would create a systemic event. UBS, the Swiss bank, comes out a recidivist and admits for the second time, oh yeah, we perpetrated massive tax frauds. Again, no prosecution, no investigation, a fine, and they walk away. And things, you know, that's when I really started making videos saying, listen, you can't let this go. You let this monster go. This Frankenstein is going to come back, and he's going to come back, and his teeth are going to be 50 times as big. He's going to bite your head off. I made a bunch of videos on that. People were like, oh, it's fine. You know, my stock, my portfolio is going great. My 401k is playing, it's fine. Well, yeah, what's HSBC trading for? I'm like, what they're trading for? They're going to kill you. Don't you understand that? But that plea of mine, it sort of fell on deaf ears. And here we are 12, 13 years later, and it's like it's open season on corporate crime.
Well, and they keep accumulating more money and power and leverage to the point where they're just going to be absolutely unstoppable. And like you were saying, that the crazy thing is that the checks and balances and the laws are in place to enforce this stuff and prosecute it. And, you know, especially with this new administration and tariff, and these people aren't paying their fair share, so we're going to shake them down and we're going to generate all this revenue. What a perfect source of revenue is to actually prosecute all these big five or big six or whatever, prosecute them and take the money back. I mean, their crimes against humanity are documented. So it'd be very easy, in air quotes, it would be very simple to, I mean, you could get hundreds of trillions of dollars in a very short order.
Well, it's never really about the money with big corporations. They've already got the money. They got the printing press. They don't need the money. With them, when they're taking money, it's not about the money. It's about the control, right? But there's two ways you could go about things. One was, you know, in the wake of the global financial crisis, remember what led up to the bailouts of 2008 was this notion that, well, the big four, JP Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America, these four banks are so big. At that time, they had between them about $10 trillion of deposits. The deposit base wasn't that much bigger. So if you go to these four banks and you take them down, one of those banks fails, it really would rip your financial system apart, your monetary system. But you didn't have to bail them out the way you did. You didn't have to give them free rein, let them do whatever they want. The real failure was, A, that you didn't prosecute anybody. That was failure number one. And B, Congress didn't finish the job. I mean, the thing to do was not let those banks. The reason those banks were able to get away with that bailout is that they put a gun to the head of the U.S. and they said, you're going to give a $700 billion bailout or we're going to blow your head off. That's what they did. It was up to Congress at that point, after the dust settled, to go into these banks and calmly say, listen, we need to restore some banking laws that went by the wayside and in retrospect are rather wise. Like the 1956 Interstate Banking Act that forbade banks from owning more than 5% share or whatever it was across state lines. That's what prevented banks from getting big. So you need to whittle those banks down to size so that they don't have the gun in their hand anymore. They might have a gun and be a lot smaller though. You need the power. You know, in the Great Depression, when 1929 hit, there were 30,000 banks in the U.S., and a bunch of them failed. I think 10,000 of them failed between 29 and 33. Today, 4,500 banks. Why? Because consolidations, and there's whales in that pond. The whales are the problem.
And that's what keeps happening. You know, the 08 crisis was funded by the 2001 TARP, you know, when George Bush said, you know, we have to abandon free market principles to save the free market. And that's what was fascinating to me, because I was actually in the financial planning field and I watched this on the deprogramming, on the news. And I'm like, if you abandon free market principles, it ceases to be a free market. So how can you abandon the principles of a free market to save a free market? Because in doing so, you make it's no longer a free market.
Right. Right. It's cronyism at that point, and it's been cronyism ever since. Once you go through that crony portal, evidently there's no going back through up until, you know, the end point is you get a revolution. That'll get you back through.
So can you break down how the central banks manipulate economies and control markets through their monetary policy?
Sure. Let's take 1929. Because money is issued as debt, you know, if you've ever taken out a $1,000 loan, there's a couple provisions in that loan paper. I can guarantee you that. One provision says under a certain set of circumstances, the bank is allowed to call in that loan. Okay. You start to get wobbly. You start to show signs of distress, miss a payment here or there. They'll yank that loan on you. You got to pay it up at the time. And if you don't pay, there's this another provision in there says, remember, banks don't lend unless it's against collateral. The vast majority of debt issuance in the U.S. is secured debt. The bank's not going to write IOUs, you know, lend you money against no assets. So when you start to get wobbly and the bank calls in that loan, it seizes the assets. So let's go to 1929. What happens? The banks started calling loans on purpose. It was a deliberately created depression, right? And that banks, when banks collapse, the deposit accounts go away. So I did that video you mentioned, Money, Mommy, Where Does Money Come From? At the end, I have a graph showing the deposit base declining like 30% over 4 years. Massive. That's your depression. Nobody has any money because the banks collapse and the deposit money's gone. There's still currency in circulation, but the ledger money, which is the vast majority of money in any modern system, that's gone away as soon as there's a bank failure. What's the significance of that? The significance is there's deflation, and the same banks that caused the depression and caused the deflation, then when things fail, even if they didn't short the assets that they bet against, which they probably did, there's documented instances of that, even if they didn't short the Main Street businesses and causing the depression, they're still going in and picking up assets for pennies on the dollar because people are so cash hungry, they're so desperate for money that the banks can do that. So the system, you know, Alexander Delmar was a 19th century monetary historian. He wrote a lot and he said, you know, before the private issuance of money, which started in really the 17th century, before the private issuance of money, there was no business cycle. There were no booms and busts. We're taught that in school, like that's just a normal thing. It's like a sine wave going up and down. There's good times, bad. Nah, it's not natural. It's unnatural. It's unnatural. The vast majority of those depressions and recessions, they're deliberately caused. And they're deliberately caused for the reason I'm saying. It enables the banks to collect and to build assets, you know, first by calling in loans and then by just buying assets on the open market when things go sideways and the economy collapses. So those expansionary and recessionary periods, the banks are they're getting paid on both ends of that game. And that's really just that single Pac-Man game there accounts for a massive wealth transfer from Main Street to Wall Street. Just that.
Yeah, and when you talk about that oscillation of the economy, you know, the ups and the downs, I am very hesitant when you look at our modern stock market, which appears to me just to be a wealth transfer in and of itself. You know, I went to college, took all the classes about investing, you know, and what, prior to 08, I think the longest bull cycle was like maybe 8 years. You know, and it's 2025 now, and I can't imagine that anybody would be investing in the stock market. I mean, that I don't know if you have any thoughts on that about as far as what's going to happen when this market corrects itself. But do you have any
listen,
ideas?
I got out of the market a long time ago. January 2008 rolled around. The very few first days of that year, you know, I was dead asleep in front of my television, but I could smell something way off because I'd been investing for a long time. I liked investing. It was probably my main hobby. You know, investing in baseball was, you know, I liked that a lot. It was a pursuit that was worth something. But the rat smell got really big in 08, and I liquidated everything I had, everything in the stock market. And I got into precious metals. I didn't know what else to do. Made a little bit of money in 08. I didn't get blowtorched by the financial crisis. And I spent the year warning people. I said, listen, this system's coming down. There's way too much fraud in this system. It's going to, mark my words, oh, no one listened, blah, blah, blah. But at that point, because there was so much fraud, and because you kind of roll the clock forward a little bit, there's no prosecutions in any of that fraud. I'm like, okay, the system's rigged. And what do you see now? Well, since then, since the time I'm talking about, which is really the window from 08 to 2012, look at a company like Citadel with co-located servers. This is a company that gets to put its computer, locate its computer right at the very edge of the stock exchange between the stock exchange and you, so that any order you place has got to go through Citadel's computers. Where did Ben Bernanke go to work after he retired from the Fed, after he became Fed chairman? He went to Citadel. He's a consultant for Citadel, the Chicago company. It's like, well, high frequency trading, that's just a scam. In other words, the way it works is I place a trade to buy 1,000 shares of IBM stock. Citadel sees my order comes in. They buy 1,000 shares of IBM stock in front of me. It kicks the price up. My price comes in, it kicks the price up a little bit more. They sell, they get paid. When the price, you know, then the price comes back down. So in other words, I'm saying in 2008, When I saw the fraud, saw the corruption, saw the no prosecutions, saw the gamesmanship through companies like Citadel's, the blatant, not just financial engineering, this is straight up rigging. Like, they can see your cards, but you can't see theirs. It's just asymmetrical warfare. I got out, and I never got back in. I wouldn't. Are you kidding me? I'm not going back into that market. That's insane. It's not worth it. At that point, I'm like, you know what? The hell with you guys. I'm going to invest in myself. That you tried taking it out of here. I'm going to invest in knowledge. You can't get to this. That was the way I pushed back.
Yeah, that's so wild, because that is the exact same year that I got out, and I haven't been back in. And then we strategically relocated to Texas in 14, and I took the exact same approach. I was like, I'm going to invest in infrastructure. I'm going to invest in dirt. I'm going to invest in stuff that we can use and tools and equipment. And and we haven't looked back. And, you know, ever since they went from defined benefit to defined contribution, and they pushed everybody out of the pension system into the stock market to get your annual, your average annual rate of return of 8 to 12%. And this is what's going to determine when you retire. It's just been a massive wealth transfer. And, you know, that's what I try to explain to people. I'm like, you hate BlackRock, Blackstone, Vanguard, and State Street, yet for one, they own pretty much all the 401ks anyway, and you are willingly giving them your money, and you are you're handing over the control of your resources directly to them. Then they do all this nefarious stuff about it, and then you say, who's going to do something about this? Well, you funded it. Like, you
right, what are you doing in their casino playing their games?
Yeah,
you're risking your capital in their casino. Are you totally deranged?
Yeah, you're funding your own demise. And that's why it's so critical to, you know, extract yourself out of that system. And we talk, and that's why I love Catherine Austin Fitz with all the parallel solutions. You know, we started implementing something called private family banking. And so, hey, we're going to capitalize. We are going to save. We're going to create a warehouse of wealth, and we'll finance our own stuff, you know. I certainly won't go to Wall Street. And whenever that bubble pops, I mean, we're going to see devastation, and we're going to see people's fortunes lost. And you'll see it lost in like minutes. It's going to happen so rapidly. And, you know, it's what makes what you're doing and exposing this, and not just exposing it. It's easy to say, you know, oh, well, they're doing this, but you're documenting it. You're providing the bona fides to say, yeah, no, look, here's where they're doing it right here. Here's where they're saying it. No, the Biden bulletin that came out.
The White House memo that came out.
Yeah.
That was one of the main drivers for my channel, was to put documents in documentaries and show you the document. These aren't my words. These are their words. I just highlight what they said. I play their clips in Congress, their testimony. The perfect video is one where I don't speak at all. I just use quotes from them.
Yeah, and that's what's unreal is, I mean, they say all the quiet parts out loud. They literally print it on paper and release it. And then people are like, you're one of those tinfoil hat conspiracy people. Like, no, they're telling you what they're going to do, you know. And now we have guys like the Jabba the Hutt guy, Bank of International Settlements, Kirsten or whatever his name
Carstens.
Is. Yeah, Carstens, right? And then he's like, yeah, well, we have the technology, so we're gonna introduce a global crypto so that we can track you and turn your wallet off and everything, just in case, you know, you spend a peso on something that we just don't think you should.
Right. Yeah, and you're talking about this, back to the stock markets a minute, and the corruption in the stock markets and the rigging in the stock markets. Keep in mind that's those exchanges, they're regulated. Okay, New York Stock Exchange, those companies in the stock exchange, they're all pretty heavily regulated companies. They have to file annual reports, quarterly reports with the SEC. There's a relatively high degree of transparency in those markets. What do you think is going on in unregulated markets like crypto? Do you think like, oh, that's, well, wait a minute, that's where the level playing field is at? Like, are you kidding? Are you kidding me?
So So, okay, so what are your thoughts on crypto? I've been incredibly reluctant just because, and I've been presented some very high-end opportunities with crypto and mining and different things like that. I've been so leery of all things crypto, and we were watching a major correction, whatever, you know, and there's this newspeak like, yeah, when it tanks, that's a correction. You know, we're watching this massive downward spiral of Bitcoin right now, which it could, hey, tomorrow morning we could wake up and it could be 110,000 a coin or whatever. But what are your thoughts on crypto? Because there's a lot of talk of, well, that's our way out of this. That's how we can unpack this and stuff the genie back in the bottle. If we could just come up, if we could tether to Bitcoin, and if we could tether our currency to Bitcoin, like this is the solution.
Yeah. I mean, let me start by saying I understand the impulse for cryptocurrencies. I get it. Because the very things we're talking about. The rigged markets, the crony system, the lack of the rule of law, the lack of level enforcement, the picking and choosing of winners and losers. You know, yeah, there's something way off with the system. But to me, the solution isn't, well, let's go to a system where there's less transparency. We don't know who owns what. And we have to rely on sort of myths like, well, there can only be whatever the number is, 21 million Bitcoins out there. Like, well, who said that? How do you know that? So I'm inherently, unless I see it proved to me the way I prove things to people in my videos, like you show me line by line, I'm on board. But this, yeah, it's 20, Satoshi said this, he said that, and there's only, now you forget that. I'm not going to part with my blood and my sweat and my toil. I mean, I bled for the company over the years. You know what that means? I mean, I worked in the big corporate life for a long time. I bled there, and I learned a lot. I'm not bleeding for something I can't see. You can forget that.
So when it comes to Bitcoin, and that's what we just talked about, how all of the BlackRock and these big banks, you know, they print the money to buy, right? And that's been my whole thing with Bitcoin is Bitcoiners are all like, no, this is legitimate now. Look at all the big banks that are buying Bitcoin. And I'm like, yeah, but they can print the money and buy it. They can buy it for nothing. And so they could easily sell it. Why would they care if they sell it? They bought it for nothing, right? So they could tank the market.
Right. So, tell me, how much does BlackRock own? What percentage of Bitcoin is owned by BlackRock? Do you know the answer to that question, yes or no? And if you don't, stop talking to me.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Privacy.
Yeah. Okay. You don't know. You don't know what they own. I mean, you know, under laws that require disclosure as it is, you still don't know what BlackRock has. And they, you know, you can look at their proxy statements and look at their 401ks, I mean, at their 10ks, and you still don't get really a total picture of what's going on. Then you're going to go to a dark pool like a crypto market, and you're going to get more transparency out of BlackRock? I don't think so. You know, I just, if I don't trust one system with transparency built in and law built in, I for sure don't trust another that seems like a lot of propaganda behind
it. Yes. Yeah.
Exactly. A lot of, when I see a lot, you know, listen, I've been on YouTube for a while. I know from when someone, they catch a star and it's like, they're putting out a lot of videos and it's like they catch fire and their faces everywhere. Suddenly their go-to person, Zero Hedge, is quoting this person out of nowhere. I mean, come on, man. That's just, you know, okay, they're not called ABC or NBC. It's just sort of the junior varsity version of that. But people fall for it. There's a lot of that in the crypto space. There's a lot of that in the alternative media space. You know, it's like, well, these are really big outfits. Who are they working for? Who's making their videos?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, especially when you see them pop out of nowhere and the quality is like Hollywood production quality.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they have instant traction and get like millions of views like out of nowhere. I'm like,
yeah,
no, I mean, you've been grinding. I've been grinding at this and you're just like, it doesn't work like that, man.
No.
It doesn't work like that.
Not unless you're a sponsored entity and not unless you have a backer who's undisclosed. And that's the problem. To the lack of the disclosure behind these people who obviously have major backers with really deep pockets. You don't know who they are.
Yeah.
No, exactly thanks. Right. I'll take a pass. And I see a lot of that in the crypto space. It's like, well, who says that? Where's the $21 million limit? Where is that? Is that some sort of asymptote that comes out of nature? What is that? You know what I mean? It's like the square root of 2 is 1.41. I mean, that I understand that. I can compute it. I'm like, where does 21 million come from?
Right. So
was 20 of the same people who have these backers say it? It's true. That's not going to work. That doesn't work for me. You're going to need more guys. 20's not enough. 20,000's not enough. Show me something tangible. I need something real.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the fact that it's all digital. And then the other fact that the path forward for control, now all the power brokers are talking about, well, the way forward for control for us to implement all this social credit is crypto. So now they, them, and those, and the Kirstens and the Bank of International Settlements, now they're saying the way forward is crypto, and it's because we can turn it on and off.
Well, it's more than that. It's more than just turning. You're right about that, but I think it goes a lot deeper than that. You know, these phones, I'm going to pick up a calculator. It's not really a phone, but let's pretend this is my phone. You know, these phones, yeah, I've gotten burned like this a bunch of times. I'm sure you have too. They've got in what's called haptics, where they kind of, you know, they kind of know which from the orientation of the phone. They can infer a lot about what you're thinking, just the way you're holding the phone or looking at the phone. I've gotten burned on Uber a few times by waiting to see if I get a lower price, and I start to tense up, and the price will go from 12 to 35.
Wow.
The reason the crypto, I'm convinced, the reason they want the drive for crypto isn't just that it's digital. It's that it's coming out of your phone. The vast majority of transactions are coming out of that phone. And that is a data harvesting. That's the mother load of personal data is in that phone. Because it's not just your money that's in the phone. It's you in the phone. They can sort of read you in that phone. I'm convinced that's the drive that's really behind crypto. It's the information that could be garnished about you, so they can make bets on you. You know, they can make bets on your success or failure, because it feeds that casino.
Mm. John, just to interrupt briefly, every guest gets a gift. John, do you drink coffee?
I do.
I mean, you're an American coffee. And you have blood in your veins, so I figured you did. But so we have our own coffee line, and we do either whole bean or ground, and we have a light, medium, and dark roast, and then we have a new what's called a white roast, which is first crack. So it's a very, very light, mild coffee, and it has a lot of caffeine. But if you were to pick a coffee, what do you think you would like me to send you?
Well, what does a chef recommend?
I really like the white coffee, but it is an acquired taste. But our light roast is awesome.
All right, you know what? I'm going to go out on a limb and go for some white coffee. Give it a whirl.
Yeah, awesome.
Thank you.
Awesome.
That sounds really great.
This has been great. What kind of action steps, what can we do? Obviously, you have the documentary. There's an inordinate amount of education with that and getting people up to speed. Just for their own personal, it's so incredible. You know, we have this government school system, and it's so incredible how just like basic economics and just what money is and where it comes from, and people are so oblivious to it. So
yeah,
obviously education is the bedrock component of this, but are there any kind of action steps? What can the listeners do to help push this movement forward, whether it's big? I mean, I guess the way that I see it is abolishing the Fed, but you know, what say you?
Well, okay, action steps. Let me back up a step. You said education. I thought of a book that's a really good book on money. Most people have never heard of it. It's called Bank Robbery by a guy named Ivo Mosley, Mosley, I think. It's really good. It came out in about 2020. It's 150 pages, sort of goes through the suite. It's really well written. And it sort of explains like the history of money. It's really, really compelling. As far as what people can do, I go back to what we talked about around the 2008-2012 period. It's just don't let your happiness depend on other people. Invest in yourself. There's a major return when you learn a new skill, when you put your hands in dirt, when you're just investing in yourself and your own environs, that's its own reward. And that's a worthy thing to do, because whatever you learn from that can't be taken away from you. So any minute of your day that you can spend outside of the casino and outside of the control grid, and you can invest in yourself, that's a worthy minute. And that's my best advice.
That is so sentient on everything that we talk about. That's what taking control of what you can control, investing in yourself. And a huge component of investing in yourself is an educational component. And then there's the rest of the real world. So much of our personal lives have been conscripted through this money machine that's literally impoverishing us and, you know, overinflating the cost of everything that we do. And when you take that control back, whether it's chickens in your backyard, you know, like Pacific Northwest people, they're like, oh, eggs are between $10 and $13 a dozen, you know? Oh. And you're just like, that's hard to imagine. And we haven't purchased eggs from the store other than in the winter on occasion. And usually even then, we still buy them from a couple other little local homesteads here. Just the power and then the satisfaction. The satisfaction you get from that is so unbelievable. And you're like, wow. And then what happens is you have a economic collapse event, like maybe a 2020, when people can't buy toilet paper or there are no eggs on the shelf. And your neighbor's like, man, I went to the store, there wasn't any eggs. Oh, you need some eggs? Like, well, I have extra eggs. Like, yeah, you know, you could either buy it off of me, or you know what? Could I borrow your skid steer? You know what I mean? And by doing that, you are literally creating a parallel economy just by investing in yourself and investing in your own knowledge. And I mean, I can't think of a better way to close out the show. And that recommendation can literally apply to every aspect of your life.
Yes.
And I think, for me, and apparently for you too, I mean, I think it is critical that for all these folks that are heavily investing in their 401k and, you know, living on someday aisle, you know, and like, well, I'm just going to pump my 401k and I'm going to retire when I'm 57 or whatever. I mean, I would not hitch my star to that wagon. I would not want, you know, and I was in the field in 2001 when the popped, and then in 2001 when the .com popped, and then that's right when I got forced out, was in 08, and that was the best thing. I was so kind of quasi devastated at the time, and I couldn't think of a better thing that happened to me by being let go, and it's changed the trajectory of our life. And you know, we're investing in ourselves, and you're just putting out such high quality, awesome content with detailed data that's attached to it.
It didn't start out awesome. It started out bad, because I was willing to fail.
Exactly.
I was willing to fail, and I failed, and I failed in public. And it taught me the same lesson you learned when you got burned in 08. Is it's like, well, once you lose the fear of failure, you're dangerous. You learn. Yeah.
Exactly. John, this has been great, man. I appreciate your time. I'll make sure that I get you that bag of coffee out here this week.
Good man.
And for all y'all listening, we love and appreciate our customers. If you appreciate our information, it is a value for value. Please go on over to thetexasboys.com. Check out what we have. We have some new lines getting ready to launch, and we love and appreciate you all. I will put the link to all of John's information down below. You can find him on YouTube at Best Evidence, and then Best Evidences. And then also I'll link the Solari report. I'll link the War for Bankocracy. So go on over there. Y'all, this information is free of charge over there. And this is real patriotic people that love their neighbor and that love their country. And they're doing what they can where they are with what they've got. And that's what we're doing here. John, thanks again so much for all that you do.
Thanks for having me. I'll be on the lookout for the coffee. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Have a great day.